I would actually go so far as to say that one of the most feminist things I have ever done is to welcome in the part of me that wants to submit to another. Because I have been to such ecstatic, multi-orgasmic places, otherworldly places through that submission. And it's not only submitting to the other, but it's submitting to the erotic life force that's moving through me, that's sounding me, that's taking me into realms that I cannot go by force. I can only go there by
Force, yeah.
submission. And so, what are women losing if we don't allow submission to be part of the flavors of our existence? Like, there is that really bleak underworld place in submission, and there is also that ecstatic pleasure, peace.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Talking Flow podcast with myself, Rafan Kibbe. Today, my guest is psychotherapist, breathwalker, women's initiatory guide, and writer, the lovely Carly Montaigne. Carly's work has evolved over 20 years of working with sacred practice and space holding, and the book, Descent and Rising, Women's Stories and the Embodiment of the Inanna Myth, is Carly's first nonfiction book. I really enjoyed reading this book and I highly recommend it if you're looking for real stories of women's descent into the underworld of the psyche and their journeys of dissolution, grief and breakdowns caused by trauma, fertility issues, the loss of loved ones, mental health struggles, sexual abuse, birthing experiences, war and burnouts, and the coming out on the other side. It's a serious but nevertheless fascinating read, and you will likely learn a lot, both about the myth of Inanna, but also about yourself. I hope you enjoy this conversation between myself and Carly. All the various links to Carly's site and social media can be found at www.rafan.co.uk under podcast. Please enjoy. Descent and Rising, Women's Stories and the Embodiment of the Inanna Myth. Amazing title. And as I keep saying, I think it's an amazing book. Can I ask you a very, very simple question to start with? Why did you write it? What's your relationship to this?
So around 8 years ago, I would say, I entered the descent myself. And it was a series of relational changes and life changes that really took me into the underworld. But I didn't know that's where I was. I just thought I was having a hard time. And then I discovered this myth through a book called Servants of the Sacred Dream by Linda Hartley. And it was like all the lights switched on inside me. It was, and I just went, wow, this is my life, the symmetry that that myth held for me. And I had never heard anything like it before. And I just got really involved with it and have been really involved with it ever since, because it just held such medicine and it kind of consecrated the experiences that I had been walking with, but I didn't have a map. So it gave me a map. It gave me a way of understanding the sacredness of my experience, if you like. It took me out of the personal and into the arms of something much, much bigger. And I felt such medicine in that in my life. And I felt such a draw towards sharing that with others. I was already holding spaces for women to come into embodied practice, to turn towards their emotions, to work with their sexuality. And this myth just pulled me even deeper down into that journey. So that's what I've been walking with for the last almost a decade now. And I keep learning. It keeps giving this myth. I think I could work with it forever, and it will continue to reveal things to me that I wasn't aware of before.
Beautiful. And how long did it take you to actually write the book?
So I started writing the book when lockdown happened. And so this was the gift that COVID brought me, was that space, really. Mm-hmm. And what happened was we went into lockdown, and the things that people seemed to be experiencing, I just thought, wow, we are in a collective descent here. And nobody's really talking about it that way. We were very much, certainly in the UK, in these old narratives of how do we fight it? How do we dominate it? How do we, you know, it was this real sort of lots of warlike speak, lots of the same old power over kind of narrative. There were very few people saying, wow, what is this teaching us? What is going on here? How do we want to relate to this? So I just thought, wow, we need this myth, and I need to write this book. And my students and clients have been asking me, when are you going to write this down? They've been asking me for years, and I had the space, so I started to write, and it's taken, so it'll be 3 years this month when it comes out.
Nice one. I'm also interested in the actual process that you went through, putting your thoughts and your feelings down on paper, which is another set of practice, which I'm sure we're going to be talking about at some point. For everyone listening, we're going to go back and forth in terms of time space throughout the conversation, but for context, can you give us your background in terms of, I know you used to be, or you still are, a yoga teacher, but what else is part of your past?
Sure. So
that would be interesting for us too.
Thank you. Yeah. So I think, like yourself, I started out as a dancer.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I danced from being like 4 years old. And then I went to the Laban Center in London and got really, really obsessed with Graham technique, loved Martha Graham, went to New York, kind of spent time dancing at the Graham School, and yeah, got so involved with that. I loved the way that she brought the emotion into the form of dance practice, which in a really particular sort of grounded, rooted in the pelvis, juicy way. It was just, yeah, I thought that was yummy. But my body was really, had like a tightness that I couldn't, it wouldn't shift. And it was only really when I started practicing yoga that began to move, and my creativity began to flow much, much more. I was a yoga teacher for about 20 years. I don't teach weekly classes anymore, but I would say that yoga still informs so much of the way that I live and how I am and what I do. And the other thread that's always been really alive for me is this sexuality, erotic, like, what is it to make love to life? What is it to live an erotic life? And I really feel that has been a question for me since I was very, very young. I have gone on to work with poetry, which I was introduced to by my first psychotherapist. He worked with poetry, and he read me a poem, and I just felt like it touched a part of me that nothing else had ever spoken to. I'm Scorpio, so I get really into the things I'm into, and I got really immersed in poetry, and ended up working with a woman called Kim Rosen, who I still work with. She's my main teacher, trained in breath work with her. And yeah, I've just been following this thread, lots of embodied practice, lots of sacred practice, lots of sensuality, whatever it is that calls me in, that helps me to deepen intimacy with my life and everything around me.
No, thank you for sharing. Amazing. Before I ask you about the actual myth, because I want to hear you speak about that, the actual Inanna. Do you pronounce it Inanna?
Inanna, yeah.
Inanna myth. I want to just go on the side slightly because you've sent me the book, which I'm very grateful for, but you've also sent me a compendium, of practices that you give out as well with the book. And I read that, really loved the fact that there was something attached to the book that people could get a bit more context, both to the practices, but also to you, to the why you're offering this and that, and also your journey in there. And since I'm talking to a lot of yoga teachers, I teach yoga myself. I know that you just shared, you talked for close to 2 decades. That's a lot. There's a passage in this compendium that you wrote, yoga was the place where I was finally moved by grace. I thought that my relationship with that practice would stay the same forever. So when I descended, I could not understand why I could no longer do the yoga asana practice that had been my daily bread for years. I thought that the practice was the thing that was meant to sustain me in the depth. But in the underworld, there was little or nothing left for yoga. Up until that point, yoga practice had been one of my primary teachers. When I descended, life itself took over as that teacher. And as much as I initially fought it, my practice had to change. I thought I was a beautiful share, and I think that a lot of us can relate to that. Can you speak some more as to both the sacrifices or what felt like the cost involved with you descending and walking with the myth a bit more in details before we actually tell people what the myth is all about?
Yeah. I feel like there's kind of 3 key points emerging in me, and I want to make sure I don't forget them. So I think it was something about the fact that practice, yoga practice, had on some level become an identity. And I don't think that's always a healthy thing. And what I mean by that is I feel like it had started to define, or I had attached to it to defining something about who I was as a person in a way that I felt like I was failing if I couldn't get to my yoga practice. It was like the perfectionism part of me, which I see in so many yoga teachers that I've worked with over the years as well. It really seems to draw in that kind of character that wants to really perfect a practice. And there's nothing wrong with that. But like anything, it has a shadow. And I think the shadow for me was this myth. And I'm saying that as in an untruth, that my yoga practice defined something about how good, in inverted commas, I was as a human being. And in a sense, I had to get stripped of that. It's like, actually, well, who are you if you don't have that shiny identity as this yoga practitioner that can get on this mat and do this every single day? What if you have to fail at that now? And what's left? What are you connecting to inside that practice that is still there when the practice isn't? Like the thread inside of the practice. Because in a sense, it's not the actual asana, though I love the asana and I love the feeling of being moved. It was the thing that was moving me that I kind of needed to get more intimate with. And in a sense, I had to lose the practice to deepen intimacy with that. And in the myth, just to pull on this other thread before it slips out of my mind, in the myth, Diane Wolkstein says, so there's this moment where when Inanna is hanging on the hook dead in the underworld, Enki, the sky god, creates these 2 little creatures to go into the underworld and basically try to help her rise. And it very specifically says in the myth that these creatures are neither male nor female. that these emissaries of God are sexless. And Diane Wolkstein, in her translation, she suggests that the reason for that is so that they don't flout the rules of the underworld. The underworld, there's no fertility there. You're not allowed to be fertile there. You have to give up. Even that erotic energy has to go to ground, under the ground. It kind of reminds me of winter, you know, when the seeds are right there, buried in the ground. They're not allowed to flower in that moment. The sap isn't rising. It has to. It has to give in and go down into the soil. And I think that yoga was one of the things that had to be composted for me in that moment to teach me that lesson at a really deep level. So, there's one more thing I want to say about that, but I guess I just want to make some space in case you have any response coming up in you, because you're a practitioner.
I'm smiling because, I think a lot of us will relate to this, and it's beautiful that you've managed to put, one, words to it, and two, you've embodied it, and you are now able to not only speak of it, but you can also guide others while going through those same stages, because I think many of us have attached our identity to our daily actions in relation to yoga, in relation to whatever we are doing. And there's a sense here of creating, to begin with, healthy habits, which eventually become actual needs, which turn into feelings of guilt, which then feeds what you called the shadow. And somehow we need to go all around it and do something with them. Hence your practice, your teaching, your coaching, your therapy. But please go into the third thread that you are in.
Thank you. Yeah, so the third thing is about the dynamic of power over versus partnership. And I think that a lot of
I want to be rude. I'm going to be rude, and I'm going to stop you right now. And the reason I want to stop you right now is because this was going to be my next question. And I want to do what I just did, which is to because I caught on to that. So, all right. Passage number two that Rafael has very, very much been touched by. And it says, as in you wrote, in modern day life, many of our dominant spiritual practices are based in a relational dynamic of power over, be that power over mind, power over the body, power over our lives. If this is the mode we are practicing in, Irishkikol will undoubtedly strip us of it. Since this is a feminine rite of passage, we must be schooled in surrender. So my two questions on that was one about power and your relationship to it, which I know you're heading towards, and the other one, which is about surrender and the fact that you're putting this as, you're relating it to the feminine rite of passage, as in this seems to be very much part of the feminine aspect of not only living, but also descending and ascending. So that's why I wanted to be rude and stop you, because yes, just to give everyone a bit of context, it's right there.
Well, I love that you were rude in inverted commas, because I really enjoy these synchronicities in these conversations and the way that they unfold. And I really enjoy meeting you, that you had already arrived in that place with me without us realizing. So thank you for sharing that with me, that's where you were headed to. Power over. So I feel like a lot of the way that yoga has arrived in the West, or perhaps been taken on in the West, I'm not sure which, it's hard to tell what dictated it, but there has been a lot of power over, there's a lot of lineage and hierarchy, I think, inside yoga and yoga schools as they formed in the West. And I realized as I was stripped of my practice how much I had been dominating my body rather than allowing the wisdom of my body to show itself. And I feel like my practice, there were places of surrender, absolutely. And I was really fortunate to be taught some beautiful practices that did allow that feminine, that did honor that feminine and sort of welcome it in. So there was that. But ultimately, inside of myself and my shadow, I was still dominating myself with it on some level in a way that I just was, it was so subconscious to me. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder about, and I do talk about this in the book, I wonder about, because we do live in sort of patriarchal capitalist structures that really do there are a lot of our structures are based in this power over dynamic. You know, we're encouraged to do better than others, accumulate more wealth than others. Our spiritual practices, I think, can be that as well, this sort of like elevating, ascending, constantly rising. And I think that there's something about this myth of Inanna that absolutely brings us back to partnership, collaboration, and a surrender to whatever things we have put on top of ourselves and others have put on top of us to see who we are under all of that stuff. And I just wonder what the world would look like if we moved into places of revealing what's inside of us rather than constantly consuming and adding things on all the time. It's really kind of an antidote to that capitalism sort of grind culture track that we seem to be so
entrenched in. Yeah.
Entrenched in. Yes.
No, thank you for, yeah. Can you speak to the surrender aspect of, and the reason I'm really curious about it, because I've learned over the years that it takes a lot of control to let go of control. It's a lovely, beautiful paradox. And, surrender to me means that. It means having the control to let go of control. And at the risk of being pedantic, perhaps, it's still a power of sort. It's still something that one has got to cultivate, educate, and grow within and with. And so, yeah, I'm wondering how and where you are right now and how you go about coaching and helping others developing this strength, this capacity.
Yeah, such a beautifully put question. For me, I think it's about the containment. And I use the metaphor of the butterfly cocoon in the book that, you know, if the butterfly doesn't have that cocoon, if there's holes punctured in that cocoon, it's just going to be a gooey mess. It will never transform into the butterfly. So I do feel like we need containers, and I feel like practices can be containers for transformation. And even this myth gave me a container to be able to relinquish control of my practice and surrender into the holding of the myth. So it's not like I surrendered into nothing, though at times it did feel that.
Mm-hmm.
But I surrendered into that which I don't think I have a name for, which only arrives when everything else falls away, including the practice that was, maybe that's what practice is pointing to. And I guess this is what I explore in the compendium, like, what are our practices pointing to? I think they're pointing to that nameless thing that we all ultimately will surrender to again when we die. And so when we're dying in our life, when we're going through a rite of passage that is a death into a rebirth, we have to, it feels like those forces take over. And that's what Erish Kegel does. It's like, well, you are going to get stripped now. And it's really not pleasant. And I think that this is where I've really enjoyed sitting with yoga teachers who have come to me, say, I don't know, going, wow, I've thought that my practice would keep me going in this time and I can't practice. And I feel like there's something wrong with me is basically what they're saying. And I think there's something about life, when life takes over as that strong teacher, our practice almost has to inversely move in the other direction. And then perhaps when life is going a bit more smoothly again, maybe practice is the thing that keeps us in connection with that thread more. But yeah, the power of the container. I'm so interested in that, whether it's a poem, a yoga practice, a musical instrument, a sacred sexuality, walking in nature, you know, what are the containers that hold us in these descents? They're not always the things we think are going to hold us. But yeah, I do agree with you that paradox, we do need some sort of containment in a way to allow us to dare to relinquish some of that control.
There you go. Yeah. To dare. Nice. Thank you very much for this, Carly. Talk to us about the Inanna myth. What is the myth? What is Inanna? Who is it?
So Inanna is one of the oldest known goddesses. And the beauty of this myth is that it originated out of ancient Sumerian culture, which is now modern day Iraq. And it's said to be, you know, I've said 4,000 years in the book. I've heard also 5,000 years. I recently went to the Fierce Faces of the Divine Feminine or Face at the British Museum, and they said 7,000 years. So who knows the exact date? But it's ancient, and it predates, the society is said to have been a matrilineal one. So not a matriarchy, so it wasn't women with power over men. It was actually, some historians say, women and men living in a more partnership dynamic, where the name of wealth and what have you would be generally in the female line, but that didn't mean that it was women holding power over. It's thought to have been much more of a partnership dynamic in society. So I find that really fascinating in terms of the then shape of the myth itself. So Inanna, the thing that inspires me about her so much is that Persephone is thought to be sort of like a later patriarchal adaptation of the myth. And many people know the Persephone myth. And of course, Hades drags Persephone to the underworld and initiates her. And what I love about this myth is that Inanna doesn't need to be dragged to the underworld by some dark god. She chooses to go because she understands that there's some call deep inside of her that she needs to go towards to be initiated into a deeper intimacy with herself and life. So she has this power about her, and she's a goddess of sexuality. And I really feel like in terms of our relationship with our sexuality, if we're gonna get deeper into relationship with that erotic energy inside of us, we have to be willing to peel back the layers of what we know about ourselves and go into the unknown. And that's what happens with Inanna. She goes down into the underworld through these seven gates, which writer Sylvia Brinton Pereira likens to the seven chakra points in the body. So she goes down through the crown, through the throat, the heart, solar plexus, all the way down to the pelvis, and then finally meets Erish Kigal in the underworld, who is not up for a sisterly loving reunion. She stakes her and hangs her on a hook and leaves her there to die. So it's this absolute, unequivocal, clear out, back down to earth, stripped, that I actually find quite... Well, a woman, Angela Farmer, who I'm sure you know of, she's a very well-known yoga teacher, and she said she finds it cleansing and total were the words she used. And she found that there was a relief inside of that, even though it was a very bleak journey for her. She named the relief, and I think I can I think I can resonate with her in that on some level. So I can tell you the next part of the story, but I feel like there's a pause there. So I'm going to pause for a moment.
Yes, because I am remembering of the phrase. You mentioned the descent into her sister and then what happened when she gets impaled and basically stripped of everything. But if I remember properly, it happened in stages where every layers that she goes down into, she's being told the same thing because she asked the question, must I really take my crown off my head? Must I really take my jewelry off? And there's a question that keeps being, not a question. There's a phrase that keeps, being repeated to her, which I'm trying to find out because I remember I read this, this passage or this chapter going, falling asleep in bed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it I had a very interesting night just because of that. I'm into the whole, you know, can I possibly direct my dreams in various places? And I don't remember many of the details of the dreams, but I do remember that phrase somehow coming back. So let me just, unless you remember what, you know what I'm talking about, right?
I do. It's the ways of the underworld are perfect, Inanna. They may not be questioned.
Exactly. The gatekeeper keeps replying, quiet, Inanna. The ways of the underworld are perfect. They may not be questioned. Humidity, I think, is what came up to me in a sense of having not only to strip bare to your nakedness, but also getting rid of your attachment to what you think makes you you, gives you the identity that you think of yourself as. So not only holding on to things, but also relating to things gives us a sense of identity, but also it's a practice. It's a practice that we've been either conditioned, that we've learned. I don't know if it's human, if it came naturally to us, I assume it did. The idea that you must somehow hold on to things and then call yourself according to those things. And the descent into this place is very much let go of all those things. And whilst you may well say something about it, the truth is the same phrase will come back to you. The ways of the underworld are perfect. They may not be questioned. So there's not even a room for, can we have a debate about this? Can we possibly talk about that? Can I keep one ring?
No. Yeah. It's ruthless, right?
Well, yeah. Now, you've mentioned the underworld, and we just mentioned it a couple of times. Can you possibly define this for us? Where are you? Where is it that you descend into?
Good question. For me, the phrase that came up quite a few times when I was writing was like being pincer gripped by fate. It was almost like, you know, being on that hook is the, you can't, Lucy H. Pierce articulated it beautifully when I spoke to her about her story in the book. She says, you can't go right, you can't go left, you can't go up, you can't go down. That's what I feel when I think of Inanna. And many women that I spoke to, because I interviewed a lot of women about their experience of the descent and that place where more than one woman described to me literally curling up into a fetal position on the ground and just not being able to move for a while. Like something just snaps and you lose, even though you are alive, you lose for a moment hope, and you just are literally flawed in that incapacity to fight. It's like it's the relinquishing of that fight, that it should be any other way than this or can be any other way than this. I think I think that's where the transition goes from surrender to submission. And I do think in my own experience, the energy of the two are quite different. So yeah, it's a place of submission and ground. in my experience, and that seemed to be what the women I spoke to reflected back to me as well.
Yeah. Can I ask you a practical question about this? Submission, the concept in the world itself, is getting quite a bad rep when it comes to social media nowadays about women submitting to anything. And the way you make it sound is this is actually a path towards reclaiming your powers. So we're talking about another little paradox right here. Can you speak to, in your coaching or therapy work, the letting go of the idea that submitting yourself is a mark of inferiority, and that actually it can lead you towards a greater control over your own destiny, your own being, your own identity? Or am I reading too much into it?
No, I love that question, because actually I think I have a pushback in myself about the idea, that any human being, whatever the gender, will never have to submit to anything. I mean, who do we think we are? Is what comes up for me first. Mm-hmm. Like, we are all going to die. Mm-hmm. We are all going to submit to death. That's pretty much one of the only unequivocal truths that I know of. So I get where the fight inside of women who might, or I would imagine that it's mainly women that you've heard saying that, I get where that fight would come from, and I want to support women in refusing to submit to things that haven't been serving us for a long time, that are not right, that we want changed. I agree with that thread. But I think what is lost if we can never submit and never find a space where we're safe enough to submit, that we can never actually drop down into the ecstatic pleasure of that submission can bring. I mean, for me, in my relationship with my husband, for example, we have found so much juice inside of power play inside of our relationship. And I would actually go so far as to say that one of the most feminist things I have ever done is to welcome in the part of me that wants to submit to another, because I have been to such ecstatic, multi-orgasmic places, otherworldly places, through that submission. And it's not only submitting to the other, but it's submitting to the erotic life force that's moving through me, that's sounding me, that's taking me into realms that I cannot go by force. I can only go there by submission. And so, what are women losing if we don't allow submission to be part of the flavors of our existence? Like, there is that really bleak underworld place in submission, and there is also that ecstatic pleasure, peace, submission as well. That I lose words at that point.
No, I appreciate this, and you put it beautifully. Thank you for sharing. Much appreciated. There's an entire chapter or part of the book called The Underworld. So I do invite people to not only get the book, but also go through this entire chapter. Before we move on to the ascent, I want to ask you a little more about the hero's journey, or let me put it properly, the heroing's journey. What are the various stages of that, besides surrendering, besides choosing to go there, besides allowing the descent to take place within one space? Are there any other stages that you can speak of, and how do they relate to Inanna?
And I miss the word you said, that you said the something journey.
Heroing, the hero's journey.
The Eros journey. Yeah. I couldn't quite hear what you'd said. So I was like, oh. So you're.
Delay, I think. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the, you mean like the erotic initiation of the descent? Is there any other aspects to it?
Yes. And the feminine archetypal path. What is that path made up of?
Yeah, so the stripping of the layers, I think I love the fact that you've already called in paradox into this conversation so many times, because I feel like that is probably a really key aspect of this. Through the gates, I feel like that's what we're reckoning with. It's the paradox of revealing the natural power inside of us and also relinquishing power. It's the acute pain we feel as the crown is removed and the beads are stripped and the robe is taken and the relief that comes inside of that. It's the understanding our own trauma more and more. I mean, I talk about in the book that for me, I was astonished when I suddenly put two and two together through my psychotherapy training and walking with the Anonymous and went, this is like an ancient map of trauma healing. How did they know that thousands of years ago, long before we have the science that we have about trauma now? Some inherent wisdom inside Enheduanna, this woman who created this myth all that time ago, she had experienced some wisdom about trauma healing inside of her, I believe, in somehow mapping out this myth. I mean, I'll never be able to prove that, but I think whatever this particular catalyst for our descent is, what it calls us to is a deeper wound. A wound that's perhaps been there forever, a wound that perhaps will never heal, but also a wound that holds a lot of our childhood experiences inside of it and some of the patterns that are familiar, and I say familiar in the root of the word familied. What's familied inside of us that we've taken on as being normal, that actually as we descend through these gates, we start to go, hang on. That's not normal. That's just all I've ever known. And wow, you're telling me there's another possibility here. Can I take off that layer of expectation? Can I take off that identity, that old story? And who am I then?
I realized, and I've heard that many times, many years ago, and I just did not realize what it meant. But I've realized, I think, over the past few years, and also through my psychotherapy training, that we tend to be the sum of the stories we tell about ourselves. And having to reinvent stories or retell stories with a better, more involved, more evolved vocabulary changes things. And this is definitely, from what I understand, a path towards walking through our traumas and what it means to understand who we are and perhaps have a better inkling, a better idea as to where we can be useful on this planet. Thank you for this. And in relation to the descent, in the book, you talk about seven gates. One being the mind, the third eye, the throat, the heart, the solar plexus, the womb, and the root. How does that relate to chakras, and is there any interplay between them?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the things that I write about in the book as well, that a lot of writings and teachings about chakras never really spoke to my experience. And I think one key thing about the feminine archetypal descent is that it takes us into the landscape of emotion. And this is where yoga couldn't meet me. And I think what made me seek out a psychotherapist myself was that yoga practice would stir my pot and bring all this stuff up to the surface. And then the yoga spaces I was in couldn't contain the emotional content that I was then left with by myself. And so I sought out a therapist to kind of bridge that gap and create another container where my emotions could live. So for me, yes, I feel like the gates are completely related to the chakras. But what I love about, again, what the myth has kind of helped bring me to and the way that my own work has evolved is the chakras is not just this esoteric sort of, how do I phrase this? I'm not really sure how to phrase this in this moment, but in a sense that we all experience these energy centers all of the time, and sometimes the more academic esoteric writing about them, I think, can disenfranchise us from our own experience. We can think it has to feel like this or this particular way or be this particular form. When in reality, I think that actually I was experiencing energetic shifts in my body that I've never read articulated in that particular way. And I think it was only through working with this myth and working with breath work and deepening understanding of my yoga practice that I realized that actually the way I was experiencing it was just as valid as that more academic approach to the chakra system. It's a really embodied, intuitive, and definitely for me had to include emotions. I'm just an emotional being. That's one of my main languages. It's one of the ways that I really work in the emotional landscape with people. So it was only really when I allowed my emotional experience to be part of my understanding of the chakra system that things really started to wake up for me in a different way. And kind of I gave myself the permission to not have to look to an external authority of what that was. So I think I've gone off piste a little bit there. But the seven gates definitely relate to this. Yeah.
Yeah. And throughout the book, you also give journaling exercises, which I love because I like the book, I like the content, but any books that I read that I'm, taken by, anytime that there's a small piece of, hey, grab a pen and answer that question and this second question, it gets me involved with the book differently as well. There's a journaling exercise here in Gate One, The Mind, where you say, the purpose of this exercise is to get to know the Inanna and Ereshki called parts of yourself a little better. And you give two and then three and four exercises. Number one, make a list of all the ways you like to be seen by others. If you get stuck, think of specific people or roles in your life and write a list of how you like to be thought of by that person or in that role. And then number two, then make a list of all the ways you hope not to be seen by others. If you get stuck, include all the things you consider to be the worst attributes of humans in general and see what comes up. And then there's some more and one in each gate for each gate. I really dig this. Awareness is where it starts, I think, for many of us, if not for everything. And being guided towards growing and cultivating a certain state of awareness, it's a beautiful thing. So you're doing a good job here because it's not judgmental. It is about giving you the tools for you to recognize certain things, to put your finger on certain things. If and when you decide to go a little further, then it's on you. It's going to have to come from you. You're not imposing this on anyone who's even reading nor even doing the exercises. But it's a case of here's a little portal into more context of what is you and how it can definitely relate to the myth and your own descent and obviously eventually your ascent. On the context, in the context of journaling and you guiding people through gaining a greater clarity and awareness of themselves, I believe you're going to be offering an online retreat to people wanting to work on this specifically. Am I correct?
Yeah, you are. So as part of the book celebration, I'm doing...
I need to be rude one more time.
Yeah.
And can I join?
Do you know, it's a really good question, isn't it? Yeah, you are so welcome to join. You are really welcome to join.
Cool. Even as a man, right? This is not just a...
Yeah, I would love men, and you know, yeah, I would love men to take part in the, to come and join in with these conversations, because I feel like there's medicine from this myth for men and women and whatever gender you mm-hmm. identify as, you know. So, yeah, mm-hmm. yes. And it's... Okay. It's going to be 7 days. It's absolutely free. I've invited some beautiful guests. Saida Deslet is one of them, who I know you've had on your podcast, who is a friend of yours. Okay, Saida's coming. So I've had a conversation with her. And
that's an online retreat. Sorry. That's an online retreat. Am I correct?
So, yeah. So this is basically, it's a bit confusing because I've got three things lined up. So this is an online retreat, which is 7 conversations, and it finishes with a live call on the 8th day. And it's happening April the 4th to the 11th. And it's completely free to sign up. You can sign up at carlymountain.com. And basically, you will receive the talks one a day over the 7 days. And then the 8th day is a free call. That is going to be there to sort of digest, move with what's been evoked over the week. And I'm calling it an online retreat because I'm hoping that what it will do is, again, provide a container for people who might want to know a bit more before they buy the book, or might just be interested, or maybe are going through their own descent and rising process, to hear conversations around key aspects of this process and hear from different people, different women in this working in, not all of them have worked specifically with the Inanna myth, but their work resonates with themes of the myth. And so the conversations I've had so far have been so rich, and I'm really delighted to share that. And then in May, there will be a 4-part online course, which then is only open to women, I'm afraid. But yeah, that will be an online 4 live calls program that will follow on from that. So yeah, my passion is really supporting people as they descend, but also as they rise. And I guess this is just to make a little bit of room for rising, because I'm really passionate about people not getting stuck in the underworld, because I think so many people do get stuck in the underworld. Yeah. That it is possible to rise, and that our Eros does rise again, and there is the potential for a rebirth. And that is the beautiful sort of fecundity and positivity that's woven into this myth. And that actually a key part of rising is also our relationship with our inner masculine and the masculine in the outer world as well. And I think sometimes that's what bugs me about the sort of more goddess movement, feminine, divine feminine movement, is that sometimes there can be an exiling of the masculine, as if the masculine is all bad. And what I love about this myth is that it gives us different paradigms for femininity, but also different paradigms for masculinity. Because to me, our masculine and feminine are always in a dance. It's not for me a question of, are they dancing? It's, what are they dancing? What's their dynamic? What's their relationship? And so as she rises, as we rise, this is one of the key questions is, how do we relate to our inner masculine? What's the dance that's going on inside of us? And how can we create inside of ourselves and hopefully in our external world something that's beyond this monoculture of the masculine that we seem to be living in, this kind of very narrow perception of what masculine even is? There's a real vulnerability that comes in through Dumuzi, who's the character that's the masculine in Rising. And, you know, a real fear for him of descending. But there's this understanding that he too has to be initiated. He too has to go to the underworld and reemerge. And only in doing that can the feminine and masculine enter a new partnership where they can support, be supportive in their dance together, rather than some of the more unhealthy, let's say, or damaging dynamics that might happen with our inner masculine and feminine and our relationship with the masculine in the outer world as well.
Mm. Would it be crass of me to ask for success stories that you've had with, now that you've received from people you worked with? Where did people start? What have they gone through, and how did they come out on the other side? As in, what was the result of the ascent, so to speak? Have they managed to integrate all this knowledge and awareness, and in what ways?
Well, this was part of the hope with the online retreat, the talks, is that, you know, every single woman that I spoke to has been through a descent and is doing incredibly creative, amazing work in the world, and is walking the heroine's energy back into the upper world, you know, through their emergence. And likewise in the book, there are stories throughout the book from all sorts of women from different socioeconomic and cultural backgrounds about how they descended, but how the descent brought them into deeper relationship with themselves, with the earth, with people around them, so that they could get the wisdom from their trauma and rise up into their lives more resourced, reignited, rebirthed, reconnected with something deeper. And I really feel like so many of the people that we see doing creative, amazing stuff in the world probably have been on this journey of the heroine's journey. And for me, I think what I would love to say to somebody who feels like they're failing and are in the depths of the underworld right now, I think the line I say in the book is, often when we feel like we're failing, we're birthing. And I feel like that is such an important message. It's like, if we can get support, find a container to surrender into, and find the sacredness inside of this journey, and allow our eros, or the eros will rise again. And the final part of the journey is, the final character in the myth is called Geshtinana. And Linda Hartley compares her to a bodhisattva. She's the embodiment of compassion. And the final piece of this journey is to call, you know, she comes in to basically bridge the gap between Dumuzi, Inanna's husband, who represents the masculine, and Inanna herself. And she offers to go to the underworld for 6 months in Dumuzi's place. So the masculine and feminine then share the journey, but that it's not a journey we take once. It's a journey that will take multiple times in a lifetime. Perhaps we only go through one massive descent, but I think there are many, many cycles of this. And we need, you know, I can't speak for everybody. I think, as I said earlier, I'm scorpionic, so there's a seeker in me that will keep going to underworld and coming back up and emerging again and again, because this just seems to be the path that I'm on. But I love that the compassion that I grew for myself, and this is what many women seem to say to me when I said, what's the main gift of your descent now that you're rising? And they nearly all said, the ability to be with myself and others in compassion, and to just be with the difficulty, and how that allows me to connect more deeply to everyone that I meet. It's like it allows, I've used the word intimacy, I think, in this call so many times, but that true intimacy for me, that beauty, can only really come from some kind of surrender to the unknown. And once we've dared to meet with that, we really do connect and relate in a different way, I think.
So very well said. So very well said. Thank you so much for this. I am going to share one short passage towards the end of the book which then I'm going to ask you when it's coming out, where people will get it, and so on and so forth. But the chapter is called Making the Sacrifice, which relates beautifully, I think, to what you just said. It's right there, beautifully written. You write, our power is the agreement to see and honor ourselves, which may not change the system or others overnight, but will certainly change us and how resourced we feel. Inanna is the bold feminine who asserts herself and is learning to take care of her own needs. She's the one in us that understands that some risk is crucial for growth. And I find you and the book also empowering and inspiring, and I'm sure anyone and everyone who reads it and spends some time with you will feel that as well. Because I'm inspired by this greatly, not only for myself, but also as a coach, as a teacher, as a trainer. And also something that I want to commend you on, I start to read a lot of Kindle books written by coaches, psychotherapists, mainly women, because I'm interested in having more masculine, feminine conversations. But there's a bias I have, and I know it's a bias, but I'm kind of sticking with it for now, which is that I do not believe one can empower themselves by victimizing themselves. And what I mean by that is that I often start to read books that are supposed to be empowering for women. But when I personally start to read them, at least the first two or three chapters or whatever Kindle gives me for free, I feel a great sense of not context being explained, but a great sense of victimization. And that can be in the writing, because it means editing your phrases in a certain way. That means that you're not claiming that things have happened to you constantly. But also, I think the spirit behind helping others ascend somewhere out of the depth, out of the underworld, requires the understanding that you will empower yourself by not only surrendering, but also taking responsibility for things that sometimes you are not responsible for. And I sense that in this book, I sense that in you. And I am greatly, greatly grateful that we got to talk a little bit about that, as short as it was, but something tells me we're gonna do this again. So please tell us about the actual book and where people can be as inspired as I am by it. When, because I got an early copy, I felt very special when I got it, and it says not for resale on it. So this is mine. This is amazing. I felt special. But when and where can people get it?
Sure. So if you want to get the compendium of practices that you read some of earlier, thank you so much for doing that. That comes as a pre-order bonus, and the pre-order ends on the 10th of March. So if you order before that, you can order from womancraftpublishing.com. And it also means that you will get the book sooner than everyone else. I think they will be arriving a week ahead of general release. And they also come with a lovely bookmark, and they're all signed. And if you do that, you're supporting an independent publisher, a wonderful independent publisher as well. So, yeah, I always love supporting indies. So, yeah, please do go to womancraftpublishing.com and order it before the 10th if you feel inspired to do so. And after that, it will be out on the 24th of March for general release. You'll be able to get it on Amazon or wherever you get your books from. I would love people to buy it, share it, let me know what you think of it. It will be a delight and probably really vulnerable when it finally flies into the world. But it's so great to have feedback like you're giving, Rafan, and I really appreciate your work. And so it means a lot to me to have your endorsement this way, and that we've been able to have this conversation. It's been a delight.
Thank you so much. No, thanks to you. Can you tell everyone who are interested in joining the online retreat where to go, what to do?
Yep, sure. So same
and
thing.
We keep the dates as well. I think it's April the 4th, the 11th.
April the 4th to the 11th. And you can sign up on my website, which is carlymountain.com. And like I said, it's absolutely free. So yeah, come along, and the recordings will be sent out to you day by day. And then there's the live call on the 11th, which I'm really looking forward to. I love holding live calls. So it will be really great to have that, to have that container and that interactive thing to finish the retreat.
Amazing. All those links and more will be in the show notes, rafan.co.uk, on the podcast. And you will see a picture of Carly and every links. And all the links and the various books and people that Carly has mentioned will be right there. Carly, thank you so very much for this. It's been fun and inspiring. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again for listening. Much, much appreciated. As mentioned, everything in terms of links to Carly's website and social media can be found at www.rafan.co.uk under podcast. All right, my friends. See you soon. Take good care and à bientôt.